Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are delighted to be with Ann Harrington. When we're talking about stories and narrative and the mind-body, I doubt very seriously that anybody, including I, would think that an historian would care about this. The history part is equally interesting, that there really is a track record, that this comes from someplace, that ideas themselves are birthed and do evolve.
Yep.
For a historian to be looking at this is very interesting.
Well, let me I'll tell you how I got interested in it, but I think it would make more sense if I first said what some of these stories are, because then it would be clear why it might be worth doing a history of them.
Yes.
The history of my own interest in this actually was not originally historical. I didn't come to this actually originally wearing my historian's hat. I came to it because I had been invited, on the basis of some other kinds of work that I'd done, to join an interdisciplinary group that was established by the MacArthur Foundation, whose mandate was to try to to investigate some of the folk ideas out there about the ways in which the minds can affect the body, and attempt to see what's really, you know, where there's really gold and where there's really something of substance. And so they had put together a psychiatrist who was interested in hypnosis. They had people interested in sleep. They had various kinds of physiologists, and they had various kinds of psychologists. And they knew they needed somebody to do the sort of the social. They had an anthropologist in there, a medical anthropologist, who so infuriated them that eventually he, and I don't need to go into the details of the story, by mutual consent, he eventually cycled off the group. And I was brought in, I think, because they thought I would be kind of more malleable or a little bit, you know, a little bit easier to manage.
Better manners, maybe.
And I had done I'd done some historical work on hypnosis. So they thought, well, I knew something about that. And from their point of view, all social scientists were kind of alike. So I was an historian, he was an anthropologist, it didn't matter, the social. And in fact, I didn't really feel I had very much to contribute initially. I was very confused why I was on this in this network, as they called it.
However, when one is invited by the MacArthur Foundation,
it was very exciting. It was a great education, and I spent 6 years there. And that's where the historical interest began, because one of the things that became striking to me was what a storied world I was in. That the best minds in the field would parade through this network, and they would tell stories. No one else really noticed this, but it was striking. And they didn't tell stories that added up to a coherent kind of consensual perspective. They told stories that were clearly in tension with each other. Some were stories that came out of the world of stress research. Some were stories that came out of the world of hypnosis research that's still much more psychoanalytically informed. Some of the stories came out of the world of social psychology and epidemiology, again, very different. And the stories were not only scientifically persuasive or powerful to varying degrees, but they were morally persuasive and powerful to varying degrees. And so I became interested how do I make sense of this? And I am an historian, and I do believe that history can often help you make sense of this. And what I finally began to become interested both in the network. All of a sudden took on a kind of new interest for me, because now it still was a group that I was going to try to make a contribution to, but it was also kind of a laboratory for me to take to get a kind of snapshot, a moving snapshot, if I can use a mixed metaphor, of the contemporary world of mind-body medicine. Certainly it's more sort of scientific or academically oriented wing, and a place, therefore, where I could begin to then go back in time and see where these ideas came from. And so over time, I began to name these stories. And I bet if I tell you the titles, you will realize you know these stories. The Power of Suggestion. That's the story about the ways in which powerful healers, charismatic doctors, can impose their thoughts into ours and change our bodies, change our minds. Hypnosis is part of the story of the Power of Suggestion. The Power of Positive Thinking. What's that story? This is a question to you.
Well, those of us who have grown up in America think of it as the Norman Vincent Peale, Dale Carnegie, that
you can do anything you want. If you just believe, if you just have positive attitude, you can become rich, you can become successful in any other way, but you can also heal yourself. So healing has been a central, you know, the positive power of positive thinking is a very powerful strand.
There's also a Calvinism in that allows one to say, well, you can heal yourself and God loves you because of it.
That's right. There's a very strong moral sort of streak running mm-hmm. through this. So there's six of these stories, and I can run through. I'll just tell you all the titles, and then we can talk a little bit about how the history would work if you want to hear
lovely.
That.
Yes, that's lovely.
So the power of suggestion. The body that speaks, this is the psychoanalytic story, the body tells the symptoms, speaks the truth that the mind is too afraid or repressed to speak, the power of positive thinking, broken by modern life, healing ties, and eastward journeys.
And interestingly enough, you break those into their own stories, that they sort of fit together, and they're sort of families within families.
The power of suggestion, the body that speaks, the power of positive thinking, all come out of late 19th century preoccupations with the unconscious. Which was a brand new idea and not just an idea that we can trace in a simple linear way to Sigmund Freud, although Freud is an important part of this story. But these are all narratives that are concerned with the mind as something that has depth, and healing comes from reaching down below the surface into the depth and seizing hold of the resources that lie in the deep regions of the mind, and that can then be brought back up and used in the service of healing. The second three are really much more products of the post-World War II era. Stress, which we think that we've had forever.
You say it's only 60 years old as
well,
an idea.
It's only 60 years old or so. It emerges in out of really the World War II setting. One of the most important reference points for the emergence of stress was the experience of bomber pilots in the Second World War, and the belief among psychiatrists of the time that they were experiencing a form of pressure, what they began to call stress.
As in the metallic sense of stress.
Well, there's more than one history that comes together here. they were using the term more in a, there was a, the term stress meant simply hardship back when, and that understanding of the word goes back several centuries earlier. And that was the term in which they used it, but they married it to a diagnosis of the kinds of pressures that these bomber pilots were under that said that it's unprecedented. It's unprecedented because they're in an environment that's completely artificial and in which they're dependent on so many things that over which they have no control. If something goes wrong with their equipment up in the air, they know there's nothing they can do about it, and so on. So
that is in contrast to the shell shock experience of the First World War, from which it builds some as you tell the story. But it, at least with shell shock, you're on the dirt and you're in physical spaces that are relatively familiar. Well, unlike the Second World War experience,
that's an interesting comparison because in some ways the feeling of helplessness was common to the two. I think what differentiated in people's minds the experience of the bomber pilot from the shell shock person was the emphasis on the helplessness or dependence of the pilot on the technology. There's something very modernist about the stress as it emerges in the late 1940s, early 1950s, and what then marries it to the ideas that you referred to before of stress as something that was originally used as to describe what happens to metals. It's a man named Hans Selye, who had actually been developing a theory of what he called stress, which was a generalized response of physiology to any kind of dramatic change, of any kind of change in the environment that the organism needs to adapt to. Stress became the response of an organism to these kinds of adaptations, to these kinds of pressures, when they became so chronic or were so severe that the organism basically pooped out, became exhausted. So stress was understood as an exhaustion of the of physiology in response to incessant environmental pressures. So you have the experience of the Second World War, you have these ideas coming out of the laboratory, and you have them coming together in the 50s in this idea we call stress. And from the beginning, it's understood as something new in the world, as something that reflects the burdens of having become modern in a very different way than any of our forebears had ever known. They suffered, but we suffered in a new way.
This is Ann Harrington, who teaches at Harvard. She is an historian herself, and she has been working on a book she is at least tentatively calling Stories Under the Skin, the emphasis of which is to look at the mind-body relationship, how the idea has evolved, where we are now with it, and where we might be going forward. Please be with us when Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, and Ann Harrington all return in a moment.